This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. The United Automobile Workers, known as the UAW, is a labor union with about 400,000 active members. 2 weeks ago, nearly 50,000 of them organized a strike against General Motors, which led to plants shutting down across the South and Midwest. The union wants GM to increase wages, reopen plants, maintain health care benefits, and reduce its use of temporary workers. Today, we're taking a close look at the strike's impact on Indiana, and we'd love to hear from you. Are you participating in the strike? Do you support it? What do you think of the changes workers are asking for? Let us know on Facebook or Twitter at All In Indiana. Joining me now is Samantha Horton. Samantha is a statewide reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting, covering business and economic issues. Hi, Samantha.
Hey, Matt.
We'll start with the most basic question. What does the UAW want? Why did they go on strike?
Well, they want several things right now. It includes higher wages, addressing health care costs as well, and temporary workers having paths to permanent employment there at these assembly plants.
What's the latest we know about how negotiations are going?
Well, negotiations are ongoing as the strike continues, and there's not necessarily a lot that's being sent out publicly about where in negotiations they are. There's questions of, you know, they are meeting still. So people know their conversations are being had. But the question is, no one exactly knows if this means, you know, will there be agreement, you know, a day from now, 2 days, a week? Who knows?
And anyone who's driven the full length of I-69 knows about the Fort Wayne Assembly Plant. But what other facilities are there in Indiana and what do they do there?
Yeah. So Indiana has four facilities. Fort Wayne is the most notable one. It's the assembly plant where they assemble trucks there. So that is the big one. It has about 4,500 employees roughly. So that's including hourly and salary. And then you have Kokomo, which is a component holding production facility. And then you have Bedford, which is castings, and Marion, which is a metal center, which does like metal printing.
You said roughly 4,500 at Fort Wayne. What are the total numbers of GM employees and UAW members in the state?
In the state, you're going to get close to about roughly 6,000, according to GM website. So this is going off what the GM numbers are, and this not necessarily meaning that all these employees are UAW members as well, though.
Where have you spent time reporting on this?
Mostly I've been up in Fort Wayne. That has been my majority of my time, just talking along with people on the picket line, meeting people at the union hall and in the community up there.
What are some of the things you've heard on the picket lines?
So one of them is, and I'll bring up a clip from one of the people I've talked with, is Pamela Ross. She's been working about 20 years at the GM Fort Wayne Assembly. And I know one of the big things has been people maybe – some of the union workers feel like the general public might have a misunderstanding about what exactly is being asked for. And here's a clip from her.
People look at us as we're greedy, we're lazy. We're not. We work. We work hard in here. Every single person. Like my job, I run with a robot. I have to keep up with that robot to get my parts made and down the line.
And so she works along the tailgate line. So it's this description of it's a very fast-paced atmosphere. The challenges of not – it's very discouraged to stop the line. That can cause a lot of problems. People could get written up for it. So there's a lot of pressure. And so that's where I think they're really pushing for these things that they feel like they maybe conceded in previous years when the economy wasn't doing so well. And now they want some of those benefits that maybe they sacrificed in the past to be restored to them.
What ripple effects are being seen from this throughout Indiana?
So the ripple effects, I mean, immediately you look at GM's plants are not producing. And so that's immediate one. But then right out the gate, then the suppliers, there's some suppliers across the street. They temporarily laid off their workers. So talking with some of those people, they're now filing for unemployment. They're considering applying for new jobs because they're not necessarily, while they're impacted and they could still be UAW members, they're not GM employees, so they don't get the strike pay or some of those things that come with it. Instead, they're kind of to the side of it. And then it continues down to even businesses. Local businesses aren't seeing the same amount of people because people are being much more hesitant on spending money. They don't have necessarily this influx of income if the plants were operating and everyone was getting their regular paychecks. They're not getting those. So now it's a lot more making wise spending decisions.
We've seen support for this strike from other worker unions and even some outside the auto industry. Is this about something bigger than one union and one company for some people?
Some people have said that. There's been these solidarity events on the weekends. And so that's where other unions have come and shown support. I've seen people from teachers' unions. The Steelworkers Union has also shown support. And even I talked with Carlos Lazarraga, who is he's a part of the Brotherhood of Locomotive Engineers and Trainmen, as well as the Teamsters Unions. And he kind of described that this is what he sees as possible, a bigger movement when it comes to workers in the U.S.
I truly believe that there is a way that we can all get along and we all can make a profit. But when greed gets in the way, and that's the religion, nothing but greed, labor is going to suffer. And we just had enough.
What has GM said during all of this?
So GM's released some official statements just kind of about negotiations are ongoing, but it's been pretty limited. There hasn't gotten really into it. That's been how a lot of this negotiation has been. It's something that I think people have reached out to GM and asked, like, you know, can we talk about it? But I think until there's a contract that's agreed upon, it's been pretty capped, even for on both sides. There's not really a lot of discussion happening on the upper level, like outside.
Well, how are the workers doing then? Do they make any money while they're on strike?
So they get strike pay, which is about $250.
And this is straight from the union?
This is from the union. So this is when union members pay their dues. This is money that could – the dues pay for a variety of things, but it also can go into helping fund for a strike if one were to happen. And so this money essentially is now being put back out and, you know, to pay for them. But it comes with – like they have to go – they have to sign up for picketing. There's obligations they have to fulfill to get that pay even. But, I mean, you're talking about only $250 a week now. So it's not – a lot of money. So that's where it comes down to talking about these community impacts.
Yeah, when you're looking at like the average pay that they get week to week, is that a small fraction? Is that a significant fraction?
Yeah, it's definitely a downgrade, yes.
And it sounds like barely enough to get by.
Yeah, and I mean, people are concerned about paying for mortgages and all these things that's where talking people, some have been prepping for this strike for a while in case it were to happen. It's one of those things where they've just have been financially planning and having to be prepared when it did happen, that they could start figuring out, okay, how do I stay ahead of this so then my personal finances don't fall apart?
You talked about the ripple effects through the community. Have you seen workers get strike support in sort of other less tangible ways from their community?
Yeah. So, I mean, communities are stepping up. The thing about Indiana is all of these facilities in Indiana are in smaller communities for the most part. Fort Wayne Assembly Plant, while it's close to Fort Wayne, it's technically in Roanoke, Indiana, which is a small community. And so you see, while businesses are taking hits, they're also trying to help each other. I know I talked to one grocery provider, a little local like produce market, and they're trying to offer like discounts to UAW members and trying to help provide to make sure that they have food and what they need for the weeks to come.
What about temporary workers? That's something that I keep coming up. What's their role in a strike like this?
So temporary workers is a big talking point right now. When I've talked with people on the picket line, it's a big conversation point. And the big thing is these workers are some of them have been around for quite some time. The one I talked to this past week was Matthew Norton. He's been a temporary worker for about 4 years at the GM facility. And this is kind of what he kind of describes. One of the major issues is being the amount of time that they get to take off from the facility.
They only give us 24 hours of vacation a year. We have to schedule it out. We can't call in. I got sick once with the flu. I was written up for it because I called in.
So it's these very limiting conditions. And so UAW members are really wanting to see GM offer more paths for those temporary workers to get permanent like roles in the company versus being constantly listed as a temporary worker.
What about workers who just can't handle the lower pay? We're talking $250 a week. What happens if they decide to go back to work?
That's what's going to be interesting to watch going forward. It's a complex issue. I mean, the union, it's going to create this rift in the union members. If for those who, if they're a member of the union, they decide to go back to work, it's pretty tense there then. Unions really see solidarity. And if someone were to have to make that financial choice that they see it more benefits to going back to work and getting that pay, it really creates a separation. There's a lot of frustration on both sides then, because union members and the union is a big thing. Is like we're collectively doing this together. And so if people break away, that starts taking away from that argument for them when they're trying to go to the bargaining table.
You've been to the picket line. You've talked to some people. Is there a feeling of optimism there? I mean, obviously, they're going to put on a good face if a reporter walks by and starts asking questions. What does it feel like when you go to the picket line?
So, I mean, these are people who are very passionate about what they want and what they feel like they deserve. And there's this conversation of with them as they're ready. When I've talked to them, been like asking about, you know, are you long-term prepared for this? You know, how long do you think you can ride this out? And a lot of them are willing to wait until they get the deal they feel is fair to them as workers. So it's a lot of, when I talk to them, it's a very much, we're in this for the long haul.
Samantha Horton, business and economics reporter for Indiana Public Broadcasting. Thank you so much for helping us catch up.
Thanks for talking to me, Matt.
Up next, we'll talk to a UAW leader in Fort Wayne and a worker from the plant there. As always, we'll take your questions and comments on social media. Has the strike affected you in any way? What do you think of the changes workers want? Let us know on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. We're back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Before we get back to the UAW strike, I want to make sure you can find us online. Every episode is available for free on a number of podcast apps, including Apple Podcasts and Stitcher. Just search for All In Indiana. Today, we're talking about the United Auto Workers strike against General Motors. We're finding out what workers want, why negotiations might be taking so long, and how the strike has impacted workers and the communities they live in. And we want to hear from you, especially if you have a personal connection with the strike. You can find us on Facebook and Twitter at All In Indiana. On the phone now, we're joined by Rich Letourneau. Rich is the shop chairman of UAW Local 2209 near Fort Wayne. Rich, thank you for calling in.
How you doing?
I'm doing great. And also on the phone, sitting close by, I believe, is Dylan Letourneau. Dylan is an assembler at the GM plant near Fort Wayne, and he's also Rich's son. Thank you for joining us as well, Dylan.
Yeah, no problem.
Rich, we'll start with you. In the first part of the show, we talked about what the UAW is asking for in this strike. Are you and the workers in Fort Wayne most concerned? What are you most concerned about in terms of the potential changes that GM could make?
The biggest concerns we got, you know, are obviously, you know, weekly contributions for insurance. Nobody wants to see insurance premiums go up. Temporary workers, long-term temporary workers, being continued to get abused inside the plant, and that needs to change so that those temporary workers have a clear path to employment. And, you know, and third, you know, the seniority people. Man, the seniority people have been neglected for three contracts in a row up till the last two. You know, so seniority people as well. They paid their dues, 25, 30-year employees in there. They deserve a wage increase. They've earned it.
I can just hear it in your voice that this is sort of been festering for a long time. Do you feel that way?
Well, it has been. And from the onset of these discussions, you know, when we went on strike, you know, I made it bigger than we made it bigger than just the United Auto Workers. It's bigger than organized labor. It's about the American worker. I mean, the American worker sells himself short every year in this country, year after year after year, and nobody stands up for him. And even those who can stand up for themselves still get backdoored by state workers. I mean, take a look at the teachers in this country right now. The teachers in the state of Indiana, the state of Wisconsin continue to get trampled on, and they're supposed to be the mentors for our kids and our coaches. You know, and teachers in this state get trampled on every single year. And look at the sanitation employees here. I mean, it's all about the American worker. It really is.
What's it like being a local union leader during a strike like this? Are you getting any information from up top about what's happening in their meetings with GM?
Well, it's extremely busy. I mean, I talk to probably more of my members now and the company than I do when I'm in the plant. I mean, yeah, my phone's ringing a lot, but that's okay. That's what I signed up for.
But are you kind of getting the information then? I mean,
can you give us a lot of information? But that's done by design. They don't want nothing leaking out, you know, and just little things to leak out that could, you know, sabotage that contract. So they're keeping everything tight-lipped, and that's understanding. I've been doing this for a long time, so I get it.
Is there anything being talked about in these negotiations that you don't think needs to be prioritized? Any specific thing being asked for that might not be worth the trouble?
No, I think, I got confidence in those who have our resolutions from each facility, and they know what's important to the membership and what's not. There's no doubt in my mind that they got our best interests at hand.
As I understand it, a lot of this has been since the recession. A lot of these sort of ripple from the recession of 2008. That's a long time to sort of be thinking about these things.
Well, and that's in the back of the minds of a lot of my members, and rightfully so. I mean, you know, regardless of what people think, you know, GM's a great company. We're employees there. If we didn't like it, we wouldn't work there. But the fact is, you know, we all took major concessions during that bankruptcy to make sure this company was viable and to get back on its feet. And we are all part of that. That wasn't a single act by General Motors. That was an act by the UAW and General Motors jointly taking concessions in every contract in every state to make sure that GM would come back profitable again. And they did. And now it's getting me a fight to share in those profits and the benefits that our people deserve.
Yeah. And so you feel like the time has come. Do you think it's a long time coming? Or do you think this is just the right time to ask for these changes?
I believe it's faster than the last few years.
Early on during these contract negotiations, GM said it offered pay raises and other items that totaled $7 billion. Spokesman for the UAW said GM only agreed on 2% of the contract terms. What are your thoughts on how negotiations have gone so far based on what you know?
Based on what I know is a good factor because, you know, I can't even comment on what GM offered because I don't know any of that to be accurate. I mean, I know they put it out. Maybe they exaggerated some of it. Maybe they didn't. But the conversations that we had with the top committee, the International Union, was the presidents and chairman, and there was no offers like that made at the time. So I never seen no offers like that other than what everybody else has seen plastered on social media.
Today marks week 3 of the strike. It's the longest nationwide strike from the UAW against GM in, my gosh, almost 50 years. Dylan, what's it like for workers to be on strike for this long?
Just basically trying to stay positive and, you know, spend as much time with our members as we can and, you know, keeping solidarity and having, you know, and that the International Union is going to keep our best interests in heart.
This might be too personal, and I apologize if it is. As a union worker, knowing that a strike could happen, does that affect your personal finances? Do you try to keep a big emergency fund ready just in case something like this comes up?
Yeah, I mean, I always try to keep an emergency fund, but I mean, we were instructed, you know, pretty early on, knowing that this was a possibility to happen, and so I think a lot of us, knowing that, kind of held a little bit extra back going forward.
Are some union workers starting to go back to work, even if they support the strike, just because they can't deal with the cut to their paycheck?
I'm actually not sure about that. I mean, I know I'm not, and I haven't heard anything.
I can tell you the answer is no.
Yeah. That's kind of the...
I would assume that, but...
That's kind of the
nobody's
rule.
Nobody's crossed the picket line if that's the question.
Yeah.
What effect does it have on the union when strikes go on this long?
I think it helps us pull together. You know, there's a lot of people in the plant that I didn't really get to an opportunity to know or to get to know very well. And now you kind of see how strong you are.
But the sacrifice from union members, when you look at the numbers, and this is probably by design from GM, the sacrifice is much greater for union members than it is for GM. Is there any thought given to that when things like this come to a head?
Well, I if you're asking me, I'll tell you there's a lot of thought behind it, because you're right. The UAW members are again sacrificing, like we did during the bankruptcy. We're suffering again. Why, they still pull in record amount of incomes. I mean, $22 million, $9 million, $5 million. Look at what some of these CEOs and some of these top executives from that company are making. I mean, they're not hurting. I mean, you're right. There is a difference, a huge difference. We are sacrificing again.
Well, what does it feel like when you when you hear things like that, when you hear about pay raises and you know that this sort of that these issues have sort of been festering since the recession? You say you support GM, and that makes sense because they're your employer. But
correct.
But how do you feel then about things like that when they come down?
You know, you think about a small business owner, and I know they have a different opinion of how organized labor works, and that's very understandable because there's a lot of business owners, small business owners, that take the risk and put the investment in. Then to have their employees strike against them if they're union employees, I would understand they're being disgruntled. But that ain't the case here. GM isn't a Henry Ford. General Motors is owned by stockholders, including us that hold a lot of stock in GM. When we bought, took a bath during that bankruptcy, if you had invested money in General Motors, you lost it all. And a lot of us did. You know, we're not sour about it, but guess what? We rebuilt that company. We did it together with the sacrifices of the UAW and some sacrifices by the company. Not one individual deserved it. Why, not one individual should be getting, you know, $30 million or $22 million or whatever it is. It's a whole lot different than an entrepreneur taking a risk. Them shareholders didn't take them risks. We did.
The plant at Fort Wayne has some history with temporary workers, which is at issue with this strike. Can you talk about how they fit into this? How is GM using temporary workers right now?
Yeah, we got one of the largest plants in North American operation. I got 700 of them in there. Yeah, they're abusing them. They're keeping them longer than they should, or they should hire them, one or the other. Some of them have been there 4 years going on in March.
Yeah, I was actually a temporary employee for about 3 years, and it's tough. I mean, you don't get vacation days. I mean, now with our new contract and a few years ago, they gave them 3 vacation days a year, which are unpaid. But when I was a temp for the 3 years, I was none. And you mean you get bumped from shift to shift all the time, and you might have a week to know, like a week advance, and then you got to like make sure you have all your affairs in order because you might go from second shift to third shift the next week. It's tough.
Are you worried about a push from GM for more temporary workers at these plants? What impact would that have?
That would have a major impact on this agreement. I mean, if that agreement doesn't come back with something for a clear path for temporary employees and instead comes back with more intense temporary employees, we'll have a big problem, a huge problem.
Rich, earlier this year at GM, a leader at GM said, quote, "We are transforming our workforce through salaried and executive reductions as we move to an all-electric future," end quote. The company said repeatedly that it needs to cut costs and reduce workforce as it transitions to electric cars and the research to get there. What does the union want to see in that transition? And do you see a smaller workforce in the future as that happens?
You know, I couldn't really speculate on how many people it takes to build an electric vehicle. Maybe GM obviously has more insight on that than I do. But what I can say are some of the holdups is when GM closes facilities, and for us, it's been around a while. We see it all the time. Like GM's been closing plants for the 35 years I've been around. But, you know, to reopen in Mexico or a foreign country instead of reinvesting in the United States is where the International Union and your local management and leadership have a problem with. Even management has a problem with that. They don't want them products going across the country. They want them here in these states. You know, and our members want them here in the states.
Nationwide, UAW's membership dropped by more than 35,000 members last year. There's been talk for a few years about why union members in some industries are going down. Automation's a big one in the auto industry. Are you worried about the UAW's future?
Well, yeah, I'm always concerned about the UAW's future, but, you know, a lot of it isn't just automation. It's profit margin. I mean, how much money do these CEOs and these companies want to make? That's what causes our jobs to go across the boundary and go over the border. That's a fact, because the labor costs that go into these vehicles are minute. I mean, you go see one of our trucks in the lot, you know, and it may be a $55,000, $60,000 truck, but you're talking $800 or $900. That entire vehicle is labor. The rest of it's profit margin above that. And we want GM to be profitable, but guess what? You know, share some of the costs with us. Share some of the expenses with us and share the profits with us. I mean, they have no problem sharing the costs with us during the recession.
What about the future of the auto industry in general? Does it feel like a risky career to get into right now? Would you recommend it?
Absolutely. The auto industry has always been risky. I mean, it's probably the most cyclical business in the world, and it has been for 50 years. The auto industry goes up and it goes down. And when it's feast, it's feasting. When it's famine, it's famine. We all know that. I mean, it's one of the riskiest careers to get into. It always has been, though.
How has the relationship been between GM and the UAW in recent years?
We've always been able to somehow reach an agreement, either at the last minute or extending the agreement. So obviously it's not as volatile as it is today, because, again, it's been a long time since this has ever happened. So obviously the relationships up there ain't that great.
Dylan,
again, I don't see it firsthand because I'm not up there, but obviously there's a reason we're on strike.
Dylan, you said you're trying to spend time with other members during the strike. What are you hearing from other UAW members?
Oh, it's a lot of positivity. You know, everyone, you know, questions like, you know, any questions that anyone would have, you know, about the contract. But obviously I don't know much more than my dad does, but or anymore. But it's been very positive so far. And everyone I've spoken with, you know, just like the whole community has kind of like come together. And, you know, there's been a lot of people like donating their time and their money and resources to the hall, you know, just to help each other out.
Let's talk about this strike in a bigger context. We kind of hit some of it earlier with some impassioned talk about teachers' unions. Do you see this as a bigger workers' movement happening across the country?
I think it is. I think there's a lot of people paying attention because, you know, like I said in one of the very first interviews I ever did, you know, this American worker deserves good health care. American worker deserves good benefits. American workers deserve a good wage, you know, and too many people think that they don't deserve that. Or maybe our fight's for the wrong reason. Our fight's for the right reason. It's for every worker out there. I'm not just talking about the industrial athletes that I represent that are on the injured reserve list every single day while I'm representing them. I'm talking about everybody, you know. I mean, not just auto workers. I mean, everybody deserves a decent wage in this country. And too many politicians in the state at the state level fight against it, and I don't understand why.
Well, speaking of those politicians, do you have any thoughts on how those politicians, including some running for president, have commented and sometimes taken part in the strike?
I know Joe Biden's been supportive of it. I can speak for the mayor in Fort Wayne, Tom Henry, been positive about it.
I think I saw a photo of Bernie Sanders walking with some of the picketers as well.
That's a fact.
So do you think that they're doing that for their own benefit, or do you think that they're supporting?
You know, I think that's a two-part question. I understand that there's a lot of politicians that like to get behind public opinion, but they really shouldn't do that because, you know, their hypocrisy can't have zero boundaries. And the fact I say, the reason I say that is because some of these politicians at the state level, federal government level, you know what they make. They make $176,000 a year. They got a minimum of a 3-year term. That's all they got to work. They get health care for life. They get options on pension, options on 401k. I don't even ask them for that for my people. I'm asking for half of that. We're asking for half of that for our people. You know, but those politicians that support us know what they have. So they probably figure, you know what, we can't be hypocrites here. We need to support the American auto worker. We need to support organized labor. That's probably why they jump on the bandwagon.
In the last 30 seconds that we have, are you worried at all about the relationship with GM getting worse because of this strike, no matter what happens?
That's always a concern. I mean, the longer it goes, you know, the more they're going to play retaliatory, you know, bargaining. I mean, I've seen it. I've lived it. I get it, you know, but then I guess we got to dig our heels in for a long haul, I guess.
Rich Letourneau, shop chairman of UAW Local 2209 near Fort Wayne. Rich, thank you for talking with us.
You're welcome.
And Dylan Letourneau, thank you so much for talking as well.
Yeah, no problem.
Up next, we'll hear my recent conversation with a sociologist whose recent work has focused on auto industry unions. He'll give his thought on what the strike says about the current state of the UAW and how much power workers' unions hold in the United States. I'm Matt Pelser. Back in 2 minutes. This is All In. This is All In. I'm Matt Pelser. Now for some academic perspective on this UAW strike. Joshua Murray is an assistant professor of sociology at Vanderbilt University. He's the co-author of the book Wrecked: How the American Automobile Industry Destroyed Its Capacity to Compete. And the headline on his recent opinion piece for MarketWatch read, "The strike against GM will likely fail." Joshua, thanks for talking with us.
Thanks for having me.
You wrote in the opinion piece that I just mentioned that the United Auto Workers Union has a long history of successful strikes against General Motors. Before we get to what you think of the latest strike, can you give us a sense of that history? What were those old strikes about?
Yeah, so it really starts with the Flint sit-down strike in 1936, the end of 1936, beginning of 37. And this is kind of the genesis of industrial unionism. So at the time, the UAW was brand new and had a fraction of the workers signed up. So they barely had any membership. And GM was one of the biggest companies in the United States and really, you know, had a model there where they owned towns. So Flint was a GM town. The mayor was related to GM management and owned shares. The police chief used to be GM's top security officer, right? So that they're in this kind of context where you don't expect them to win. Yet, with a couple hundred workers, they're able to shut down 75% of GM's production and kind of bring major concessions, including recognizing the UAW as the sole bargaining unit for the workers. And by the end of 1937, all of General Motors' workers had joined the United Auto Workers. And by 1940, they unionized Chrysler and Ford also. So that strike is this super successful strike in the sense that it really starts unionism. Then you have, during World War II, leadership agreed to a no-strike clause, and workers just went on strike anyway. They went through a rash of wildcat strikes, and those strikes were incredibly successful at gaining concessions from all of the big three auto companies. And then you have the 1946 strike was successful in getting overtime pay, I believe it was. So you just have this run from 36 to about 1950 where strikes almost always gain major concessions, and it ends with the Treaty of Detroit in 1950.
What was it about those strikes that made them successful versus today when it's kind of hit or miss?
Right. So in our book, we're really interrogating the decline of the big three U.S. automakers. And what we come upon is something that also explains strike success, which is during the time period that I'm describing when all these strikes are so successful, the big three use a form of production that we call flexible production. And it's really similar to what the foreign automakers use now. So think of Toyota or Nissan or Volkswagen. And one of the features is just-in-time delivery, but it's more than just-in-time delivery. What they build around just-in-time delivery is minimal stockpiles, concentrating suppliers and assembly in the same geographic area so that it's easier to deliver parts, and sole sourcing contracts with suppliers. So you'll have one or two suppliers that supply all of the model parts for all of the models that the company makes. And the tie-in to the kind of industries that production structure facilitates innovation. But for the workers, what it does is it increases their leverage, what we call structural leverage. So that a strike at one of those key suppliers that's a sole source shuts down all of production. And you don't need a national strike to do that. And when that production is shut down, the company doesn't have large stockpiles of inventory to wait out the strike and make it last longer. So kind of our conception of what makes a strike successful is the ability to shut down enough production that it causes enough pain to the company that they're willing to make concessions, and to do that in an efficient time period, right? So the longer a strike has to last to hurt the company, the harder it is for workers to accomplish that because they also sacrifice while they're on strike. So if a short strike is able to shut down an incredible amount of production, the company will give major concessions, and that's something doable for the workers. And so that structure really heightened the workers' leverage, that a small amount of workers could do a great deal of disruption to the system, and a large amount of workers was just unbeatable. And that's changed. So between 1950 and 1970, the big three kind of dismantled that production system because they recognized it gave workers so much leverage and started to kind of piecemeal put in things that reduce that leverage. So they started carrying larger stockpiles. They started contracting with suppliers in a redundant fashion. So rather than having one company make spark plugs, you're going to have multiple companies make spark plugs, and they're going to be separated by thousands of miles. That way a strike at one of them isn't going to shut you down. And as this happened, it reduced innovation. And when the foreign auto companies came in using that system and being innovative, it led to a situation where GM really had to compete through lowering labor costs. And that kind of spurred the outsourcing that we've seen over the last half century, which has also contributed to reducing labor's leverage, right? So one of the things I talk about in the piece is that even though it's a national strike and it's shutting down all of U.S. production, much of GM's production happens outside of the U.S., so they're not shutting down all of GM's production.
So we've talked about the reduction in power that the unions have. What other changes, I guess, separate from that and with respect to that, in the span of time that we're talking about, what other changes have you seen in the UAW in that span?
Yeah, so there's kind of a shift right around when the companies are shifting their production and lowering the power that that unions have. The unions also changed their strategy of kind of what they're aiming for. So, you know, from the 30s through the mid 50s, the union leadership and the rank and file, the UAW really, they had kind of a broader vision than for society and worker power in society. So it wasn't just about gaining, health benefits and wage increases, but the idea was to really negotiate what role workers were going to play in making production decisions and how do we distribute the wealth that's produced by the workers, both to those workers, but also kind of society-wide. So issues like that we think of today, like universal healthcare, those were being talked about in union circles as something that unions could actually push. And after their leverage kind of decreased and they realized that, they shifted to kind of strategy that was really just about securing immediate benefits for their membership. It's almost a defensive strategy. So you can't think big when you don't have a lot of power. So at the very least, secure a gain in wages or, some extra benefits. And while that's understandable, long term, that's been a losing strategy for unions as they get a little bit on one contract, but it ends up being pulled back on the next one. So what we've seen over the past decades is GM might give a wage increase to workers, but then they start using temporary workers who aren't on that wage, or they close the plant down and move it overseas. So while technically it seems, you got a 13% raise, that 13% used to count for 400,000 workers. Now it's only 49,000 workers. So as a whole, workers are less well off. The ones who are in the union and lucky to have the jobs are fine, but the rest of the workforce isn't. This is where you've seen the decline of these old centers like Detroit and Flint that used to be among the richest cities in the world that are now just struggling, right? Because it's not employing as many people. And so that's one thing is that unions have become more defensive as their power's weakened. And leadership has more and more taken on an approach that's what I would call partnership, where they view themselves in partnership with management. And again, if you're in a partnership and one partner has much more power than the other, the agreement that's going to come out is going to favor the one with more power. And in some ways, union leadership seems to have forgotten what the source of worker power is, which isn't in negotiating. It's in the fact that management needs their labor, right? And that being able to withhold that labor in key moments when it matters the most gives them a great deal of leverage. So kind of long-term trend has been a decline in that. But then this year and last year, all of a sudden break that trend kind of labor-wide. There's been a rash of strikes that I think it's the most since 1980, I want to say. And not all in the auto industry, right? The teachers union strikes are really big ones. But it's not just that they're striking, but they've been wildcat strikes. So for instance, in West Virginia, the teachers went on strike and then their union came to an agreement and ordered the teachers back to work. And the teachers didn't like the agreement, so they just didn't go back to work. And they stayed out on strike against their leadership. And it ended up that they got a better deal. So originally they wanted a 5% raise, and the agreement they came to was 5%. And then the local legislator voted it down to 4%. And when the teachers stayed out on strike, they went back, the legislature went back and then agreed, okay, we'll give you the 5%. And so kind of rekindling that power that the rank and file have that is rooted in them and not in leadership, if that starts to spread to the auto industry, that could change the equation of what's going on.
I want to stay with this comparison to other unions. Do these changes in the UAW mirror what's happening to a lot of other workers' unions? You mentioned the teachers' union throughout the country. Does anything set the UAW apart in respect to this as well?
So my research is just on the auto industry, so I know for sure the kind of sense of how the structure of production changed and weakened them. My hunch from listening to people that have studied other industries, not necessarily looking for this, but just, talking in general about what's happened, is that it seems that's something that happened in a lot of industries around the same time. So in some ways I'm hypothesizing here. I don't know how widespread it is, but I think that there's a common thing among a lot of different workforces where production used to be very concentrated in regions and it became dispersed and then eventually moved overseas. And this weakened a lot of industrial unions. And then what replaced manufacturing was service industry type of jobs that are more difficult to find that leverage. It's not the same choke points where you have suppliers and you can cut it off and whatnot. And the result has been a labor movement that in general was weakened and strikes became less effective. Like you said, they're kind of hit and miss. And a result of that hit and miss is workers became less likely to go on strike, which makes sense. If you're a worker, it's a big risk to go on strike. You make a big sacrifice. If you feel like there's a good chance it's not going to work anyway, you're probably not going to go on strike very often. So there is a common thing. Now, what sets the UAW apart is I think it is easier to identify those structural choke points in the production system that give them power. It's easier to do things such as block the delivery of new parts so that, you know, if you have a company in Mexico making cars and GM wants to ramp up production there to make up for what they're losing here, if the parts can't get out of Detroit to there, then they can't ramp up production. So you kind of, that's really obvious with things like teachers unions or nurses unions. It's a little bit harder to identify that type of power, but I also think theoretically that every worker has that power. It's just a matter of identifying. So it's not that they don't have it. It's a matter of thinking about what is it that I, through my cooperation and our cooperation as a group, lets the system function. And if we withhold that at a time when the system needs to function the most, we have the greatest leverage.
Back to your prediction that the strike will likely fail, and I must disclaim that we're recording this on Friday. The show airs on Monday, so if anything happens over the weekend that proves that you're wrong, and I'm guessing a lot of people are hoping that you are, maybe even you are. We saw some information come out about sticking points in the negotiation. Wages and temporary workers seem to be kind of at the center of it. Were you surprised by any of these details?
No. Maybe a little surprised, but in a good way, in the sense that the sticking point of temporary workers really seems to be one of those longer term views and is being driven by rank and file workers. So the union leadership didn't really announce what the strike was about or give any heads up to the workers what they would be negotiating. And the workers on their own have kind of put through the media when people talk to them that the major issue for them is temporary workers in the two-tier system. And that is a thing. If you think, if I'm a worker who is on the new tier and I'm making $30 an hour, I could have the opinion of, what do I care about the temporary workers? I want to raise. That's the most important thing, right? And that's not what they're saying. So it's almost this solidarity. They're saying, this might not help me immediately, but it divides us as a whole to have some workers do the same job I do, but they get paid less because they're temporary. It divides us as a whole to say, well, you were hired in 2008, so you're on one system. You were hired in 2015, you're on a different one. And so they're kind of putting an emphasis on solidarity and sticking up for their fellow worker. And that's something that will in the long term give the union more power, and I think is a really important development. But it's also something, because of the nature of GM's production system that my book talks about, means it's going to be a sticking point for them. They lose market share and they lose advantage. And so for them, the big way it isn't about workers. It's not that they're not creative. It's not that they're not innovative. It really is about the system that they have just makes it very hard to implement innovations. And so for them, the way that they're able to compete in the long term is to have their labor costs low. It's the one thing they can control. And so the temporary worker for them represents a key way to compete. And so I don't imagine the company is going to be very willing to concede on that. That to them, I would think, is a major concession. So if the big thing that the UAW wanted was wage increases and maybe, you know, health benefits where they're paying less, you know, something to control the costs, I could see the company making some concessions on that and then keeping the temporary workers. But if the workers decide that a sticking point is they don't want the temporary workers, they don't want the two-tiered system, I think that that could be something the company is not willing to concede on unless forced. So I think that the workers could win, but they would have to make this last a really long time. And that's just really hard for them because they're sacrificing a great deal, right? They're used, the average worker at GM, I think that I read something that said they make $1,200 a week, and now they're down to $250 a week once they start getting the money from the union that they have saved up. And that's a huge, that's a bigger sacrifice than GM is making. So that represents a cut of 75% of the average worker's pay, whereas GM is losing maximum $100 million a day. But they make $400 million a day on average if you take last year's annual revenue. So they're losing 25% of their daily revenue, whereas the workers are losing 75%. That's tough, right? That's tough to ask the workers to win that battle when that's such a disparate leverage.
Joshua Murray, Assistant Professor of Sociology at Vanderbilt University, thanks for your perspective and thank you so much for your time.
Thank you.
Our producers are Drew Dodlin and Maggie Galon. Scott Cameron is our managing editor. Our show is engineered by Chris Flood and Adam Gross. If you'd like a podcast of this show or any past show, you can find it on Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Join us tomorrow when we'll sit down with journalist and author Tom LoBianco to talk about his new book, Piety and Power, Mike Pence and the Taking of the White House. Until then, we'd love to hear from you. Find us on Twitter and Facebook at All In Indiana. I'm Matt Pelser. Thanks for listening. This is All In.